For a good few years, it was basically impossible to roam the internet without encountering some heated debate about cancel culture. For some, it was a particular evil of the modern internet age. For others, it was a way to protect society from deep moral transgression. But in each case, it was generally assumed that this cancel culture was something new, a novel demon to slay or ally to employ. But I just don't think this is true. So, I want to move beyond discussions of cancel culture and talk about the general social practice of ostracism and scapegoating. That is, the punishing of a single person for a grave moral ill on ethical grounds, both in cases where this is justified and unjustified. And we'll be doing this by using one of the most unsettling short stories of all time, The Lottery by Shirley Jackson. My name is Joe Folly, and this is Unsolicited Advice. 1. The Greater Good. The Lottery follows a small village which has quite an unusual ritual. Each year, the citizens draw lots, and whoever draws the marked lot is stoned to death by the other inhabitants of the settlement. This is thought to ensure a good harvest for all. We see the process of the citizens assembling, each person taking their lot, the selection whittled down to one household, and then each family member stepping forward to receive their bit of paper. Eventually, Tessie, the mother of the Hutchinson household, is chosen, and although she protests, she is carried off to be stoned. Shockingly, even her young son joins in, following the people around him and the culture in which he has been brought up. As I said, the explicit justification given for this is that the village will have a good harvest if they make this sacrifice. That is, it is for the greater good. Thus, the village folk give us a utilitarian justification for their violence, and I want to look at this from two angles. First, is it true? And second, even if it were, how should we react to that? Jackson deliberately picks a pretty implausible claim as the village's reason. There is, obviously, no actual connection between the performance of strange rituals and there being a good harvest. Rituals are powerful social tools, as we will see in the next section, but they just can't directly affect crop yields. It's just a fact of life. The idea that this is truly for the greater good is thus highly questionable. This mirrors something that we discussed in my video on Ursula K. Le Guin's The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. We are very used to accepting hypotheticals like, if you had to kill one person to save five, would you? Or, if utopia depended on the suffering of an innocent child, what would you do? These are fantastic for testing out our moral intuitions, but they can also train us to unquestionably mimic this kind of trade-off model in the rest of our lives and the rest of our moral decision-making. There is some merit in the notion that good things tend to come with a cost. The cost of great skill or learning is time, and the cost of a community is some degree of personal sacrifice. Likewise, in situations like saving one person or five, the lesser of two evils might truly be to save the five and let the one die. But this can quickly tip over into forgetting that the lesser of two evils is still an evil, and that, in the real world, it might also be an unnecessary one. In his work on scapegoats, the French thinker René Girard discusses how, historically, scapegoats are often given responsibility for some vaguely defined moral sin. So-called witches were often accused of sabotaging harvests. Religious minorities were accused of casting spells or participating in forbidden rituals that brought ruin on their city. By his unwitting incest, Oedipus was thought to have brought a plague to Thebes. In each case, the solution is clear. Punish this one person and solve a much larger issue. If we eliminate the scapegoat, then the problems their moral profanity brought will disappear with them. While in the lottery, Tessie does not commit some grave evil, the narrative still cannot help but make her bring this on herself in some ways. First, she says that her husband Bill did not have enough time to choose his lot, and that it is unfair that her household was picked, to which another citizen chides her, telling her to be a good sport. Even her husband advises her to shut up. She then suggests that her husband's adult daughters should also draw lots with them, further impugning her character. Finally, All the while, she cries that none of this is fair, bringing the social order of the village into question. The narrative paints her as a social disruptor, and in doing so, subtly makes her a threat to the community. Even though we are seeing the ritual from an outside view, and most readers are horrified by it, Tessie is still scapegoated as a somewhat deserving victim in the little space that the story has to do this. It is like even our external narrator cannot help but rationalize the pain by thinking she must have done this to herself. Finally, the purging of the victim is the route to secure the strength of the society. In that way, she's given a strange and mystical power that only her persecution will unlock. She will dispel the evils of the village and ensure good harvest through unknown, quasi-spiritual means. Although most of us hopefully do not practice human sacrifice for the sake of agriculture, this is sort of the point. The lottery takes a ridiculous justification for ostracism and execution, but the townspeople do not see this. To them, it is very sensible. If this is what they must do to make sure that everyone is fed, then we might do the same if we were in their place and believed the things that they did. But we almost certainly have our own versions of this for our own practices of social ostracism, or even just our everyday cruelty. One paper from Park and Park found that just observing someone's ostracization causes many of us to perceive them as less human. They also survey previous research, noting that while victims of social exclusion or malice often do receive some measure of sympathy, many people also view them as, in some sense, deserving their fate. This is corroborated by other research which has found that social differences made someone more likely to be ostracized. This is not to say that everyone supports social ostracism, and there are many who do empathize with or aid the victim. Nor does it show that social ostracism is always undeserved or unjustified. Sometimes someone actually does bring it on themselves. However, it shows our capacity to justify cruelty using basically whatever's to hand. And, importantly, we may not even be aware that we're doing this, because they will seem like good reasons to us, just as the people in Jackson's story saw their own reasons as perfectly defensible. But things get even more complicated, because Gerard does think that scapegoating is a solution to one major societal ill: internal social disruption. He thinks that in a time of great social crisis, where the unity of the community is threatened and mimetic rivalry abounds, a scapegoat genuinely can bring it back together. By pinning the community's misfortunes on a single person and casting them out, the entire community is unified against a common foe, and in their shared violence, they become one social organism again. In this way, it is actually to the society's benefit to use this scapegoat as their sacrifice. It truly is for the good of the group, just not in the way that the villagers intended. Well, at least the part of the group that isn't currently being scapegoated. However, this leaves us with an interesting dilemma. Because whether or not the scapegoat truly does deserve their fate, the utilitarian outcome may be pretty similar. If Gerard is right, it will still safeguard the group at the cost of this one individual. And indeed, Gerard thinks that most scapegoats definitely do not deserve their fate. So then, we are left with a further, quite chilling question. Do we need scapegoats to maintain societal cohesion over long periods of time? And if so, is this trade-off worth it? Are we willing to sacrifice another innocent person for the good of the group? And what happens when we find ourselves in the role of the scapegoat? Gerard has his own very complicated answer to this question that we don't need to get fully into. But I do think that these questions are very much worth asking. After all, it's not clear that Tessie questioned the lottery until she drew the short straw. The ceremony is so trivial to her that she even forgot the day on which it fell. I think that this line of thinking can promote a little bit of unpleasant self-awareness in us all. When have we deceived ourselves about our motivations? And where have we disguised our own cruel instinct to pin society's sins on a single person as an altruistic action for the good of all? Are scapegoats ever justified? And how would we know when social ostracism truly is for the best? And if we disagree with scapegoating, where have we fallen short of this idea? But if you want to improve your critical thinking skills, then I recommend you check out today's very kind sponsor, Brilliant. The eternal dilemma of the student is how to learn technical subjects like maths and science. These topics can get pretty heavy and even downright frustrating. But this is where Brilliant comes into play. They offer a variety of courses, from learning programming languages to different topics in physics, to even understanding the ins and outs of AI systems. And each one is curated by award-winning research teams. With Brilliant exercises, you also learn by completing activities, which helps you retain the information much more easily. It's also just much better than the alternative, which, more often than not, is scrolling. Using their app, you can complete quick lessons, exercises, or refresh your memory on key topics wherever you happen to be. And I guarantee you, you will feel a lot better than if you just spent that time doom-scrolling on social media. If you want to improve your critical thinking, which will definitely help for some of the stuff that we will talk about today, then I recommend you check out Brilliant's introductory logic courses, which are great tools for discovering what logic is about and learning some of its inner workings. To try everything Brilliant has to offer for free for a full 30 days, visit brilliant.org/unsolicited advice or scan the QR code on screen. Or you can just click the link in the description. It doesn't matter which. You'll also get 20% off your annual premium subscription. So please do check that out. But anyway, back to the video. 2. Rituals, the crowd, and responsibility. One of Jean-Paul Sartre's most radical ideas was that we have total responsibility over all our actions. For him, there is no running from our decisions or chalking them up to other factors. Though we often think of freedom as a desirable thing, Sartre said we were condemned to be free. That is, condemned to bear the painful responsibility for our choices. As a result, he thought we employed a number of different mechanisms to dispense with this responsibility, and he called these mauvaise foi, or bad faith. In other words, freedom is kind of a lot of pressure, especially in very difficult contexts and very difficult decisions. So much so that we would often rather not have it at all. And one of the ways that we might relinquish this responsibility is by appealing to prevailing social opinion or some kind of ritualistic superstructure. Now, to clarify, I'm certainly not saying that all rituals are bad. I've actually spoken about them in very positive terms in the past. At their best, rituals can bring a community together, foster a sense of shared solidarity, and reaffirm everyone's commitment to the good of their fellow community member. However, rituals are just tools, and they can be used for either good or ill. They can create these wonderful outcomes, or they can be used to separate, demonize, and enact cruelty. This is definitely worth keeping an eye on. Nietzsche especially spoke at length about the use of ritual or social license to disguise an underlying will to cruelty. When confronted with the urge to do something brutal or vindictive, we can both justify it and relinquish our own moral culpability by incorporating it into a wider societal practice. He is talking in the context of religion, but it could just as easily apply to rituals more generally. The striking thing about the lottery is how no one in the town, save Tessie, the victim, sees anything morally questionable in stoning someone in this way. This is despite the fact that they are, on the whole, a peaceful community, and I'm sure that they would balk at stoning on any other occasion. It's only in this context that the brutality becomes something more acceptable, more dignified. The murder is no longer just a murder, it is part of the fabric of the town. It is their custom and tradition. And to get rid of it would be almost unthinkable. Most of all, it is sacred. The idea of sacredness or sanctity or holding something sacred has had quite a lot of philosophical attention in the last couple hundred years. With the advent of more mainstream non-belief and more religiously pluralistic societies, it becomes easier to ask not just where the religions are true, but what the idea of a sacred thing does, both psychologically and sociologically. The views on this topic are very diverse, and I won't survey them now, but many of them recognize a few key points. A feeling of sacredness is often linked to power, reality, and righteousness. To take just a few examples, the Christian God is not just associated with raw power, what with being omnipotent, he is also associated with a higher level of being, as well as the font of all that is good. Spiritual ceremonies, in many mystic traditions, often involve temporary access to some higher truth, one that is seen as both transformational and redemptive. At the opening of the British Parliament, the King's emissary summons the representatives of the House of Commons, who first slam the door in the emissary's face to signal their own independent power, before processing to the House of Lords to hear the King's speech. The elaborate pageantry of it all is meant to emphasise the strength and moral authority of both the monarch and of Parliament, so it's not just in religion that we find this peculiar sacred mixture. The relevant factor for our purposes is the moral authority that's bound up in the sacred. The ritual context allows the people of the town to view their actions as inherently sacred and therefore undeniably good. It deafens their ears to any cries of dissent. When Tessie repeatedly says that this is not fair or not right, this gives no one pause for thought, because they view their actions as representative of a higher authority. It allows them to wash their hands of any harm they might have done, as they're no longer autonomous agents, but instead instruments of ritual. This momentary relinquishing of individuality is part of what allows rituals to be so unifying. But it also temporarily rids everyone of the duty to think and act for themselves, and to bear full responsibility for their actions. It is fertile ground for the sort of banal evil highlighted by Hannah Arendt, where ordinary people commit awful actions pretty much unreflectively because it's the path of least resistance and everyone else is doing it. This links very closely with the modern field of crowd psychology, or the ways that people act when they are enmeshed in groups. According to the elaborated social identity model, crowds tend to view themselves not as individuals, but as one big shared identity. This does not mean they are inherently chaotic or irrational. Indeed, they might be driven by very definite goals. But each individual's wishes, desires, and actions are subsumed within the group. The interests of the group can then become a kind of temporary moral arbiter. As Drury and Riker put it, commenting on an experiment where one group were given extreme power over another, people did not automatically slip into roles with which they then thoughtlessly complied. Rather, only when they actively identified with a group did they then creatively act in terms of group norms. Researchers in this area often focus on how reactions to a crowd either strengthen or weaken their group identity, but we don't need to go into that here. We only need to recognize this general idea that in crowd contexts, people can identify very strongly with the crowd and take on the crowd's aims as their own. This context then justifies actions that would normally be considered entirely off-limits, and may also diffuse responsibility for any cruel actions among the participants, leading people to feel less individually culpable for them. I should also mention that this is by no means always a negative thing. The resistance movement in Nazi-occupied France was a shared identity where people submitted to a group's needs over their own, yet this was in service to a very noble goal. It's not that group actions or rituals are uniformly undesirable. As I said, they can be a big part of what makes a cohesive community. But I think that the lottery, and writers on rituals and the sacred more generally, ought to warn us against specifically naive participation in events like this. If we don't apply any critical thought to these phenomena, then we could end up indulging in its worst aspects. This is especially important for when we are not simply bystanders, but active participants in what some would label group cruelty. Maybe they are wrong, but perhaps it's worth checking. And we might also remember that we are not immune to the power of crowds. In the moment, where our own individual identity is subsumed within a wider one, it will, at first glance, seem that the group is totally justified in its aims and its acts. This makes it all the more important to take a step back and think about whether, in the cold light of reflection, we would still agree. Moreover, this can encourage us to think about our own societal rituals and habits much more generally. A term from popular philosophy that has re-entered public discourse recently is Chesterton's fads. This is an idea from G.K. Chesterton that you should only get rid of certain practices or rules if you know what they're there for. That is, you shouldn't go around knocking over fences before you know why they're there in the first place. I think this is an eminently sound and sensible idea, But I also think that it must be tempered by what we might call Jackson's stone. Namely, that if, after careful consideration, you know that a particular social practice doesn't serve its function or is based on erroneous foundations, we should consider dispensing with them before they can do any more damage. Although knocking down fences with reckless abandon is a pretty bad idea, we also can't let stonings go unquestioned simply because we've always done them. 3. Defensiveness and challenge. That thought brings us very nicely onto our next point, because something that's often overlooked in the lottery is this brief exchange between two village members. Some places have already quit lotteries, Mrs. Adams said. Nothing but trouble in that, Old Man Warner said stoutly. Pack of young fools. Old Man Warner is a die-hard lottery traditionalist. He bemoans that the current officer of the lottery is not treating it with the gravitas it deserves. He mutters that it's his 77th year in the lottery, and the idea that it might eventually be stopped is appalling to him. At first glance, this level of defensiveness looks a little bit odd. Sure, it's not pleasant to have something that you hold sacred questioned, but it is a bit extreme to immediately and repeatedly call them fools. It's all a little bit the lady doth protest too much. Warner even admits that when he was younger, he lived an unorthodox lifestyle, and may have even been against the lottery himself. So I think there may be something deeper represented here. Let's think for a moment what a genuine moral challenge to the lottery would mean for someone like Warner. He has been a willing and enthusiastic participant for years, has stoned person after person for the sake of this particular ritual. To admit that it is wrong now means facing up to the 77 murders that he has committed. More than anyone else, his identity as a good person is on the line, and so he reacts with hostility. When someone says, maybe we should get rid of the lottery, or is there something wrong with stoning someone every year, what Warner hears is, you, Warner, are an awful person and complicit in dozens of unjustifiable killings. What's more, Warner is an old man. He does not have much time to make amends for any potential misdeeds. His self-perception as morally good is dearer to him than ever. I think we can all be at least a little bit prone to this sort of thing. When confronted with someone who has a different moral system to our own, and we secretly suspect a more defensible one, it is awful. It threatens our self-image as relatively kind and moral people. At its worst, this can manifest, like Old Man Warner, in open aggression towards this person we think may be better than us. It's a strange sort of moral envy that then gets twisted into anger and hate. We sense the challenge to become more moral, but we don't want to take it on board, so we have to find some way to dismiss them, proclaiming them as fools or otherwise viewing them as beneath listening to. Looking back, I'm pretty sure that I have done this in the past, and I also imagine that many of you will have done as well. It's pretty easy to do, partly because it often happens automatically. We don't consciously decide to view this other person as a threat. It instead manifests as a knee-jerk emotional reaction. To quote the philosopher Jonathan Glover, who's commenting on those who commit torture, anxiety about the moral boundary may only suggest the uncomfortable thought that it has already been passed. The idea here is that far from instigating a change of heart in these people, moral challenges suggested that they had already done something entirely unforgivable, and the only way left to go is down. And this notion of forgiveness or forgivability seems very important here. Is someone more likely to actually change their behaviour if they know that forgiveness is an option and that there is a route back to the rest of humanity? Interestingly, this is an incredibly under-researched question, and one preliminary study on forgiveness noted that, except for one study of which we are aware, Kelln and Ellard, 1999, research examining the effects of forgiveness on repentance is essentially non-existent. That study, by the way, did show that a retributive attitude increased a subject's defensiveness, making them less likely to comply with future requests, while a forgiving one made them more receptive to such requests. But to my knowledge, no one has attempted to replicate this experiment, and it had a sample size of 75, so I would be wary about drawing too sweeping conclusions from it. The question, then, is left to us to answer. What is the role of forgiveness when it comes to moral transgressions, especially when norms have changed? Do we choose to extend a hand to those people who were previously the scapegoaters, or do they become the targets of fresh ostracism? I'm sure it will partly depend on context. In practice, very few of us have the infinitely forgiving approach of Christ, or the Buddhist monk who once declared that if he were beaten with fists, he would merely be grateful that he were not beaten with sticks. At the same time, drawing the circle of forgiveness too narrowly would also be a mistake. It might satisfy our craving for immediate revenge and to see a punitive kind of justice done, but it may also entrench the punished in their ways. It reminds me of the observation by Dostoevsky that punishments can only ever be one part of a social moral system. Alongside it, we need redemption and transformation. And that transformation cannot simply be imposed from without. No matter how much moral censure old man Warner endures, it may only strengthen his support of the lottery. This is how he perceives those who wish to ban the practice: as dangerous outsiders who threaten social collapse and him personally. Perhaps, if he knew that he could still find a place in a post-lottery world, this might gently encourage some internal reflection. Of course, there is no way we will answer the problems and questions around forgiveness in a YouTube video. But I wanted to bring this up because I think the topic is woefully underexplored in popular discourse, especially that surrounding social punishment. In theory, we do have a legal framework for forgiveness in the eyes of the state. Someone serves their sentence, accepts any further non-custodial measures, and then, as far as the government is concerned, they are no longer a criminal. They have, as it's commonly put, paid their debt to society. But social opinion is a slightly more nebulous beast. Obviously, we can't lay down strict rules for when someone is forgiven and when they are not, and it's not even clear this would be helpful, considering how nuanced moral transgressions can be and how messy our intuitions are. But in some ways, how we choose to treat old man Warner is key to undoing this cycle of scapegoating that characterizes the village in the lottery. Forgiveness plays a key role in Girard's analysis of scapegoating. It is how he thinks we can move past our desire to scapegoat and into a new social ethic. Girard was heavily interested in the story of Jesus because he saw it as a potential alternative to collective violence. He particularly focuses on Christ's outcry of, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they are doing." For Girard, the cycle of scapegoating can only end by someone choosing to forgive those who have scapegoated before and showing an alternative way to deal with social unrest. Namely, that we see the previous scapegoaters not as intrinsically evil agents who are out to get people, but as not fully aware of what they are doing. Old man Warner does not know he is a brutal murderer. He thinks he's upholding the sacred rituals of his society. Although Girard is a Christian, you certainly don't need to be one to take this idea on board. For him, we now have a choice. Do we decide that Warner is a monster, pin the whole nasty business on him, and stone him in place of Tessie? Or do we accept our own collective responsibility for scapegoating and learn to change? Girard states this will involve a truly radical shift in our thinking, and I'll leave it up to you to decide if he is right. But either way, what are your thoughts on a theory of forgiveness? And how do we break these cycles of violent scapegoating, blame, and then more violence in response without being naive or letting ourselves get taken advantage of? This is a vital question that I think many of us have ignored for too long. However, this forgiveness element is only part of Girard's model for transcending scapegoating, and the second is arguably even more difficult and even more demanding. 4. The Moral Mirror. I've told this story on the channel before, But when he was asked how he would judge the success of his theories, Girard once responded that it would be a success when you recognise yourself as a persecutor. In the midst of Girard's writing, with its intensive reference to myth, legend, literature, anthropology, psychology, religion, and more, it is easy to imagine scapegoating as an abstract idea, an academic's tool for understanding broader trends in history and culture. And it is undoubtedly that as well. But Girard's message also hits much closer to home, because most of us will have been in the role of the scapegoater far more often than the scapegoated. And if he's right, then we may not have even realized this. A key component of Girard's analysis of scapegoating is that the scapegoaters do not understand that they are scapegoaters. This is partly because of all the factors we've already examined. The scapegoaters demonize the scapegoat. They make it seem like the scapegoat is responsible for their own punishment. They wrap up the process in ritual. In some of his later writings, especially on the Book of Job, Girard talks about the need for a confession from the victimized person, at least in later retellings of the event. This is part of how we convince ourselves that the scapegoating was not just for the greater good, but even occurred with the victim's willing consent and direct admission of guilt. Girard points to show trials in totalitarian states and how the performance of an impartial judicial process alleviates a sense of guilt from the participants. No longer is this an act of oppression or of cruelty, but is instead a willing sacrifice who hands themselves in for the good of the community, and in doing so, restores peace to the polis. This is not just so the more involved scapegoaters can deceive the general public, but also so they can deceive themselves. And this elaborate cover-up can happen very slowly. As the distance between the event and the perpetrators increases, and the scapegoating begins to be viewed in a potentially less favourable light, the story can change to whitewash the scapegoaters. And we may do this without even knowing it. But what does this mean for us? Well, it is to recognise our own complicity in this scapegoating process. This is the other component to moving past it that we alluded to in the last section. We must realise the relative innocence of the victim. Not that they've done nothing wrong, but that they were not responsible for the overall discord or disorder in our communities. This does not necessarily involve saying they were totally stainless, because, well, none of us are. But rather, that this was not the motivation behind our scapegoating. That whatever our outward claims of justice, we were probably more concerned with having an outlet for our anger and our will to cruelty than a disinterested regard for what is right or for the good of our society. It is, in effect, to recognise where justice has been a mask for vengeance and where misplaced ethics has hidden our execration. The lottery is what scapegoating looks like to someone not involved in the process. To the villagers, it is a fact of life and a moral good. We see the realisation of the lottery's injustice happen in real time to Tessie. Initially, she displays no more objection to the lottery than anyone else. She is joking, smiling, and laughing. Then, as she draws nearer and nearer to becoming the victim herself, her mood shifts. All of a sudden, it doesn't seem so righteous. It seems unfair and unjust. This reaches a crescendo when she herself is chosen and dragged off to die. Then, all she can think is, it's not fair, and she repeats it over and over again. She has gone from viewing the scapegoating from inside the group to outside of it, as her execution coincides with her expulsion. What for so many years seemed totally unobjectionable is suddenly abhorrent when she is on the receiving end of it. And yet, since she is now on the outside of the group, her word counts for nothing, and no one heeds her warnings. Even her young son is handed pebbles to take part in the grisly ceremony, indicating just how futile her cries truly were. And yet, all is not lost. In the villages that no longer have a lottery, there is another perspective, one that recognises the barbarism of this spectacle and provides a genuine alternative to the way of life in this village. But to take this path, the villagers would need to come to a certain kind of self-consciousness. They would have to, temporarily, put themselves in the shoes of their victim, or even just a passerby, and demystify the event. Stripped of all its moral pretensions and ritualistic symbolism, what is happening? It's the subjugation of one relatively powerless person by an overwhelming group. And viewing it this way is illuminating for those who have held their moralistic framing as sacrosanct. Of course, such observations do not simply apply to the lottery, but any form of collective violence. We may decide that, on balance, a given action of collective violence is genuinely justified, but we are only in a position to make this judgment by taking an outside view. Interestingly, we do see the beginnings of this in Jackson's story. The accoutrements of the lottery, like the black box that contains the lots, are decaying. The villagers keep their distance from it, as if unconsciously aware that its role is repellent. We are told that there was once a chant, which has now been forgotten. Perhaps this gradual decay will put enough distance between the villagers and their so-called sacred practice that the realization will suddenly snap into place. But what would allow this change to occur? Well, I submit it is doubt. Doubt in something that seems self-evident, invincible, and natural. The same kind of doubt that enabled people to question slavery or witch burnings or imprisonment without trial. The sort of doubt that compels us to look inside ourselves and question our own motives, that forces us to take a cold look in the moral mirror and see where we are not living up to our ideals of a good person, but are instead driven by ugly, cruel, or egoistic desires. It is, perhaps, the hardest kind of doubt there is. And yet, it is also the crack in our moral edifice that allows a beam of daylight to shine through. Of course, we cannot doubt everything all of the time. I'm not suggesting that doubt is an unalloyed virtue in its extremes. But when we find ourselves justifying actions that we would ordinarily consider reprehensible, or casting someone out of our moral order with no hope of return or reconciliation, it may be worth stopping and considering whether our reasons truly are ironclad, and whether our motivations really are innocent. For me, the most valuable message behind Girard's analysis of the scapegoat is less the mythological or anthropological implications, fascinating as they might be. It is rather that mankind is a stranger to itself, especially when it comes to moral matters. We have depths that we would rather not plunge, and things that we hide from our conscious awareness that we would not dare to look at. But if we do learn to face up to them, to the excesses of our harm and the darker crannies of our wills, then we might just learn to constrain them. At the very least, it will warn us of our own imperfections and help us to pause before we turn our ire on our next victim, be they deserving or entirely blameless. But if you want more analysis of humanity's less savoury components, then check out this video on how we all may be a little bit hypocritical and whether that might not be the worst thing in the world. Thank you so much for watching, and have a wonderful day.